Hello and welcome to Pumped, the inside podcast by Schwalbe. I'm your host Tobias Wogon, and I'm talking here with Schwalbe athletes from different disciplines, from downhill to cross country and from road riding to triathlon. And today I'm talking to one of the big legends of downhill sports, Rob Warner. Most of the people know him as the voice of Red Bull TV, because he's commentating the downhill and the cross country World Cup for the live broadcast. But the most people don't know that Rob is also one of the most successful downhill racers back in the days, and was the first Brit who ever won a downhill World Cup. What he thinks about the sports getting more and more professional and how he got from the starting line to the commentator box, you will find out in this episode of Pumped. Hey Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
So no problem, mate. There's not much going on at the moment in the world, so it's nice to have someone to talk to be honest.
So the most people know you as the voice of Red Bull TV and the voice of the downhill and cross-country mountain bike racing. Nowadays, only a few people know that you were a successful downhill rider before. How did you get into mountain biking?
I got into mountain biking when I was a kid, actually, when they first came out, which was probably about, I'm going to age myself here, probably about 1984, 1985. I was still at secondary school when mountain bikes came out, and I was big into motorbike racing at the time, and I still am, actually. And obviously, when mountain bikes came out, I had to have one like every other kid. And then it developed from there, really. It was like, probably the first, you know, at that age, I didn't have a motorbike on the road or anything. So it was the first kind of taste of freedom, really, just pissing off on this incredibly shit, I have to say, mountain bike as they were back then with plastic tyres, like, you know, gears that, yeah, it was a rally. I had a rally Mustang. It was one of the first ones in the UK. And it was, yeah, it was awful, man. But yeah, it was one of the worst bicycles I ever owned. But it was a mountain bike, so you know.
Was it already with suspension?
Oh God, no! It was a full rigid 15 geared thing. I mean, it was mind blowing because it had like 15 gears, and it had. I remember one of the big selling points was a rear derailleur, like cage protector thing, like this bent bit of metal that hung off the wheel nut and just like supposed to protect the wheel, protect the derailleur. Yeah, it was, you know, it was the early days, but they, you know, it was all right. It was a means to getting out and about, and it was my first taste of mountain bike, and of course they've got a lot better since.
So it's crazy when you think about how shitty all the bikes were in the beginning.
Yeah, even in fact they were pretty shit really until, you know, quite recent times. In recent times, they've really become good with tubeless tyres and the chain not falling off. Just simple things, I think. You know, that really make them, like, now you go out for a ride and, like, you almost don't need to take any tools, you know? I haven't had a puncture all year. Yeah. I haven't had nothing. I've had nothing. I've just been riding. It's been amazing. So, yeah, I love the mountain biking now. It's obviously is the best it's ever been, you know?
Yeah. So I did a little bit of research on Wikipedia, and it says that you're from Reading.
No, I was born in Reading. Reading's the ghetto. I'm from Henley-on-Thames, the posh bit.
Okay, because, I mean, Reading is the town where Ricky Gervais comes from, and...
Yeah, that's right. Well, Slough's just up the road, actually. I'm close to where they filmed The Office, you know?
Oh, okay.
I drove around once looking for The Office, the building. I think I found it in Slough.
And then you moved, after you're born in Reading, you moved to another place in...
No, I've lived in the same house, mate, forever, actually, pretty much. I live across the street. Yeah, exactly. I was only born in the hospital in Reading. No, I never go out to Reading. It's far too dangerous for a person like myself.
Because you're so shy and...
It's just lethal over there, man. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I never go out to Reading, but... No, but yeah, that's right. I was born there, but now I've never left Henley-on-Thames. Is actually where I'm from, really, just outside Henley-on-Thames. So yeah, I've been in the same area for all my life. Yeah, I've only moved 100 feet since I was born.
Okay. So yeah. How did you manage to become one of the fastest downhiller in the world from there?
That's a good question, probably, really, because it was there's no hills, you know what I mean? So I never trained for downhill, even when I was doing it, apart from like on Giant, we had training camps. But I mean, I went out and like a lot of the riders do in the south now, you know, like Brendan Fairclough and that, they're not from so far away. We haven't got much elevation here, but you can put together short runs that will work for you. There's dirt jumps. But for me, it came from the fact that I was, like I said, you know, I got into mountain biking almost as a way of being fit for motorcycle trials. And motorcycle trials was my life to that point. I was on a bike every day. I skipped school. I got kicked out of college. All I wanted to do was ride motorbike trials. You know what I mean? And it was very much my life. And it was everything. I'd get up in the morning and just go practicing all day. So I had a head start on all the mountain bikers for technical skills back then. You know what I mean? It was a new sport in the early 90s. But I would say, because I came from motorcycle trials, I was some way ahead technically on, you know, if you gave me a track with some real technical bits, then I'd be one of the quickest through it. You put some pedaling in there, like most of the tracks back then had, and I'd be out the back, you know, I wouldn't even be in the top 100 because I didn't see mountain biking as downhill mountain biking really as requiring pedaling. It never really sat well with me. So I used to just roll, you know, but yeah, that's how I got into it anyway. And it was just bikes, isn't it? It's just and a mountain bike, downhill mountain bike with a travel and that. And you ride it, you know, the way you ride it stood up. It feels a lot like a trials bike, actually. They're quite similar. So yeah. It was pretty easy to go across to it, like a lot of riders did back then.
So you didn't have this cross-country background than other riders? I think PD was racing cross-country a little bit. And
yeah, he was, yeah. That's right, yeah. But no, I didn't, no.
You're coming more from the technical background. And then you were...
I come purely from motorbikes, Before, you know, in my lifetime, I was at an age where I could ride a mountain bike when they first came out. So, in Europe, maybe not in America, they came a little earlier. But, you know, like I say, like the mid-80s, I was riding a mountain bike. Like it was a rally mountain bike. So I've sort of been along for the whole journey, really, on the mountain bikes, I think.
And then you were the first Brit who ever wins a downhill World Cup.
That's right, mate. Yeah, for '96, bro. Yeah,
That's long ago.
That was a good day, that was, mate. Yeah, that was a good day, that was. Yeah, yeah, that was funny.
But
yeah.
In the track, there was quite some pedaling in it, right?
I mean, oh my God, mate. It was.
How did you manage to win this race?
Well, it was my first year on Giant. So until then, I'd had all little shitty deals with no money. And then I got on Giant, who paid me like what felt like a king's ransom at the time. Do you know what I mean? It was a lot of money. But my real motivation then, 1996, that year, it never was, the money was always a motivation, but it wasn't the main motivation. The main motivation for me was to just have this, I'd never really travelled, and I didn't want to blow it, I didn't want to get kicked off Giant, which was, you know, well, they did end up firing me, actually, probably twice during my time with them, you know, because we were a bit out of control. But I got a bollocking in Caprun, and I was really, don't get me wrong, I was enjoying the lifestyle, is what I'm saying, you know, and I didn't want it to stop. And in Caprun, there was a big, you came out of the pinball section, this high speed, I mean, it was pretty wild to no brake, this sort of narrow gully, like fast, where Beneke crashes actually in on race day in 96. And then you'd come out onto this fucking flat field, and it was like literally flat. And I came out of this in qualifying, I came out of the pinball section and just rolled like I did. I was really anti-pedaling, plus I didn't have the fitness for it. And I almost rolled to a complete stop on this flat field. And the bloody team manager, Johan Lammerts, my team manager, who was a Tour de France stage winner. So it was quite interesting for him, I'm sure, hanging around with me. But he was stood there, and when he got to the bottom, he came down, he was like, what were you doing? I was like, what do you mean? He was like, well, I timed you on that flat bit and you lost like 40 seconds. And I was like, yeah, I didn't pedal. He went, no, what, you actually nearly rolled to a stop. And I was like, yeah, I did, yeah. So anyway, all the results came in. I looked at them and I can't remember exactly, of course. It was a long time ago. But I remember thinking that, well, if I did pedal, because I was like, I'd like 40 seconds back. I'd lost 40 seconds on this section, but I was like 35 seconds off the top five sort of thing. So I was like, well, if you pedal here, you could have a good day tomorrow. But the motivation was there because I hadn't had any results. Actually, the bike we had wasn't particularly good in 96. It was still basically an ATX 990. It was a single crown fork and like, I think, 3 or 4 inch travel bike. They, you know, better bikes were around. But in Capron, that bike was good because it was all pedaling. Anyway, and I just thought the next day, you know, you're going to get fired by Giant. This lifestyle is going to end if you don't do something. So I pedaled out. I nailed the turns at the top on the fire road and sprinted like mad out of every corner. Like I was on the pedals as quickly as I could be. And by the time I got to the pinball section, I knew I hadn't done a lot wrong. And I'd no brake that. And then I came to where I was, like, where I apparently lost nearly a minute the day before. So, and I, you know, I stood up and sprinted and I sprinted and I sprinted and I sprinted. And I pedaled all the way to the bottom like I'd never pedaled before. And when I crossed the line, I was in such a mess because I don't think, probably had never been that out of breath, that everyone was trying to say congratulations and pat me because I took the fastest time at that point. But I just rode out through everyone, like basically having almost a panic attack in my helmet, not being out of breath. And I pissed off down the road. Like I went down the road and just tried to recover. I was like dying, literally dying. And then I came back and, you know, there was only a few riders left and I was leading. So it was, yeah, it was pretty cool. But that was it. Yeah, it was the one time that I really pedaled. And after that, because I'd had a win, you know, I had a good year in 97. And then I pretty much signed out, really, because I had big contracts for good money for, you know, multi-years, and I lost pretty much any motivation I had. So that was it. I went back to just partying, really, for the rest of my career, I suppose, yeah.
So you were motorbiking your whole life, and then you came into mountain biking, grown up in the area with no hills, and then you're the first one who wins the first Brit who wins a Donald World Cup. How did that change your life? Or did it even change your life?
I don't know. No, it probably didn't really change me. Like, you know, I'd had good results before then. Like at my second ever World Cup in 94, which was in Canada in Monson, and I was third. You know, and it wasn't completely out of the blue. I'd been top 10 plenty. So, no, I don't think it really changed my life. It was a big... It changed me a little bit in the... Like, I resented mountain biking for taking me away from the motorcycles that really were my sport, that I really loved. So I always had a bit of a... It's hard to say, really, and it sounds weird, but there was always, like, I always... Especially after that win, I was like, right, you've done that now. You've won it. You were the fastest on the day. One day, you know, you beat everyone in the world.
That's enough.
It kind of ticked a box for me a little bit. Yeah, it did. It did. So it changed me in that respect a little bit. But I had a good year the year after because I was fully fired up the year after. But then after that, it kind of, my motivations did wane. And I probably only did enough just to keep getting paid well and to be at the races, you know. And but a lot of my problems with downhill mountain biking came from the fact that the tracks back then were so flat and so pedally, and I had not signed up to pedal a mountain bike, you know. As far as I was concerned, as long as you were strong and could hang on, you shouldn't really need to be able to pedal. Do you know what I mean? It was downhill racing, and those tracks sucked, man. I mean, they were bloody like 7 minutes long, and like, you know, like with 5 minutes flat pedaling and like maybe 2 10-second technical sections where you try and make all your time. So, yeah, it was quite frustrating in the early days. And I think the sport is a lot better now than it was back then. You know what I mean? Like the tracks, and of course it is. It's way faster and more spectacular.
But winning this race is a little bit like a more successful Eddie the Eagle story.
So. Yeah, that's right. A little bit, yeah, that's right. Fucking hell, you won't get me on a ski jump, though, that's for sure. But yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, from where you're sat, it is. For me, it's not really, because it's just all bikes, you know? I'm just bikes. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, it's cool, isn't it? It was good. And mountain biking, we had a lull after that. But in the mid-90s, it was as big, if not bigger, than it is now. You know what I mean? Like, the sport was massive. There was so many fans there. So, yeah, it was definitely... looking back, it's, you know, of course it is one of the big highlights of my sporting life, but I only put it there level with like winning national trials and things like that, to be honest, you know. Yeah, I'm pretty weird like that. Yeah, strange.
So in the final phase of your career, you already have been commentating on events beside the Donald Sport.
Yeah, I do a fair bit. I'll commentate on anything that you put in front of me. I won't say I'll do it well, but I'll definitely have a go. Yeah.
And then how did you get from the starting gate of the Donald World Cup to the commentator box?
So it was, I know when it was. It was 2006. So like I said, in 97 I was good. Then 98, 99, 2000 I sucked. I kept breaking my legs because I was heavily into motocross. All the money. My dad would never let me do motocross. It was always motorcycle trials. So when I got all this money, I just spent it basically all on motocross and tried to be a professional motocross rider. I was out on the motocross bike like 3-4 days a week with my mate who was actually a Grand Prix rider. And I had a spate of broken legs. And then in 2001, I thought, right, you're out of work here unless you do something. I was still on Giant. So I had a good year that year. Not good, but I ended up the World Cup in 11th overall. And that bought me a few more years of money, you know what I mean? So, yeah. But 2006, I had a contract with Giant again to go and race the entire World Cup series. But at the same time, about 2 weeks before, I think it was just Vigo was the first World Cup in 2006. Anyway, and I got a phone call from Red Bull, and I had no ties with Red Bull or anything with Red Bull at all at this point. And they said, and I knew them because I'd covered a couple of events for them, like as in writing stuff for a magazine. I wrote for Mountain Bike UK magazine. Yeah. I had a column in there and I wrote a few articles. And I got sent to Brazil to go and cover this race down a gold mine. Anyway, long story short, Channel 4 covered it. And they interviewed me just as an expert. Like, they were like, what do you think? And I was like, la, 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 yeah, it's great. And then afterwards, they were like, well, Rob's really good on screen. You know, he's like, you should use him a bit more. So Red Bull rang me up, this girl from Red Bull, and said, would I be interested in doing the Red Bull X Fighters series as a host with James Cracknell, the Olympic rower? And I was like, yeah, bloody right. It was like Mexico, Brazil, you know, all these like exotic destinations. So I didn't tell Giant, but I just cleared off and started doing that. And then Vigo, I got that. It was bad, really. I had a tickly cough, right? You know, like a cough you can't stop coughing.
Yeah.
Like really bad. So I got this cough medicine I bought in a chemist, and I drank a lot. I started sipping it and it really eased my cough. But by that, I drank basically a bottle of it the day before because I was desperately trying to get rid of this cough, and I was hallucinating. I remember talking to these fish in a big fish tank in a restaurant. Like I had my hair cut off and everything. I was complete. And then the next day, and we were drinking and partying, the next day in the start-up for qualifying, I puked, didn't qualify. Only time in my career I didn't qualify, and it was my fault, you know, like I hadn't got a puncture or something like that. And that was my last ever race. I never went back after that. I went into doing X Fighters for Red Bull and tried to, you know, put all my energies into that. I was done with mountain biking. And then I did that for a couple of years. And at one of those X Fighters, I met a bloke called Raymond Delieu, who owned Freecaster, who thought I was a professional TV host. And I wasn't. I was just, because I met him at X Fighters. He was like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm doing a show for Channel 4 or whatever, for Red Bull. And he said, oh, we could do with you. I've got the rights to the mountain biking, which, because remember, after Eurosport left, the rights went and it wasn't on telly. Yeah. And mountain biking died a death, man. It was like the lights went out. It was done.
Yeah.
All the trucks stopped. It died. You know, early 2000s, it was Palmer left. Everything went bad. It was gone. But mainly because the TV rights went, I think. It just got forgotten. And so that was it. Yeah. And then it was only about a year later that he found out that I was actually a mountain bike racer, not a TV host. So it's quite a mad story. But that, you know, and that was it. So 2008, that must have been the end of 2007. It was in Spain at Madrid X Fighters that I met Raymond. And in 2008, I went to Maribor, and that was the first time I ever commentated on anything. And I picked a dude up from the airport, and I was like, hello, mate. his name was Matthias. I was like, so you're a professional TV host, right? Thinking that he'd front it and like I'd just be the expert. And he was like, no, you are the professional TV host. And I was like, you're joking, aren't you, mate? I'm a mountain biker. What are you on about? So anyway, yeah, I was so nervous before that first broadcast that I think I drank like 4 pints of beer before we even got in there. And, you know, and that was the start of, that's how Freecaster was. That was the start of, the very start of my commentating career. And it was drunk for about the first 3 years, man. Well, until Red Bull came in 2012, I didn't do a broadcast sober. I couldn't. I was too nervous. So, yeah, funny.
Yeah, so the first years with Freecaster, they were really wild. I mean,
they were wild, mate, weren't they? Oh, my God. Jesus, can you imagine putting that stuff out now? It wouldn't be good.
I mean, I think Danny Hart's world champion run topped everything with the emotion and stuff. And I even had this Freecaster app on my phone with all your quotes.
You haven't still got it, have you? I lost it. It's gone, isn't it now?
Yeah, it's gone. So I was looking for it a couple of months ago. And well, that was crazy. So what changed when Red Bull came on board? Was it still clear that you would continue commentating, or was your job on the line?
No, I honestly don't really know the answer to that. The fact is that Red Bull definitely took a massive chance and used me, right? And I mean, and I don't think, you know, I think they probably felt like they had to at that point because, you know, I had the core audiences following. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so Red Bull come in and they were like, right, we got the TV rights now. And I suppose they didn't really think like, well, you know, our this following, this the audience that we already have, we don't want to lose that. So I don't know. They definitely gave me a massive opportunity and they definitely took a massive chance on me. I mean, Christ, you're talking about Red Bull here, like, you know, what a brand it is to put like basically a drunk person fronting World Cup races for them. So, you know, it did change. It changed quite quickly and it changed for the better. But it was a very, very difficult, a really difficult change for me to make. Like, I remember that I got flown out to Austria, to Salzburg, to meet Red Bull, to meet a fella called Chris Ryan, who's my boss. And, you know, I was pretty cocky. I was still like in the realms of thinking I was the hot shit mountain bike dude, you know what I mean? Like ex-pro racer and all that. I bowled into the Red Bull offices and he was like, so you've been trained as a mountain bike, as a commentator? And I remember I actually laughed, dude, at this, you know, like in Chris's face, basically. I was like, what's this dude on about? What are you on about? Training? You can't have training for commentary. And anyway, I went away thinking, I don't want to do it any different. This is how everyone likes it, you know. And it was, yeah, and it was really hard for me to take on board that it had to be different. And Red Bull sent me to a coach, a guy called Gary, who I sat with for hours and hours and hours learning how to commentate, right? You know, I'd been doing it professionally, I suppose, for Freecaster for, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And it became... And it was very uncomfortable and it was very difficult. I mean, it was pretty soul-destroying for me. Like, I'd start talking. He'd be like, right, commentate on this. And I'd be like, wait, right, stop. And it was like that. He was like, what are you doing? And it was, what do you mean? Well, why are you shouting? Why are you not breaking? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? What's this? And it was an unbelievable amount of information to take in. But my God, you know, it blew my mind and I couldn't handle any of it. I was like, well, this dude's a football commentator. He doesn't know anything about my sport. It's an action sport. I need to shout about. Anyway, I couldn't really get it. And I think it was on year two for Red Bull when we went to Lourdes that Red Bull flew Gary out, my commentary coach, out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they sat him in the office with a headset on, so he could directly talk to me during commentary. You remember, I've already got a director in my ear.
Yeah.
But then they put Gary. Gary had a direct line. And literally, right, because I couldn't get it. I couldn't do it as it needed to be done. And it did need to be done this way. At the time, I couldn't see it either. But now, 100%. And he actually sat there, right? So I had the director going, you know, like, replay coming in 3, 2, 1, like all that stuff going on. But then I had Gary in there going, stop talking. And I'd be like, and here comes Danny Harb to split one. And then in my ear, I'd get, stop talking. And I'd be like, sat there in silence. And it would go on, dude, this silence. I'd be like, fuck, I need to say something. Don't talk, Rob. Don't talk. Don't talk. And then, like, it feel like an eternity had passed. And then he'd go, and then it'd be like a picture change or something on the screen that would kind of mean it was a good time for me to come in. He'd be like, okay, Rob, gently take it away. And I'd be like, and Danny Harb thundering down this track, you know, and then I'd pick it up again. And then, like, it'd be 10 seconds from me and whoever I was with then. I don't know if it was Claudio back then, probably not. And then he'd be like, stop, Rob, pause. And it was all like this, dude. And it was like commentary by numbers, you know, like colouring by numbers. It was like that. And this dude, anyway, it was difficult. And I got through it. And I walked out of that commentary booth thinking, that's by far the worst commentary I've ever done. And no one's ever going to watch me commentate on a race again. And the first thing I did was rung one of my best mates. I rung Bertie Dog and I was like, Bertie Dog, did you listen to the commentary today? And he was like, yeah, hell of a race. And I was like, yeah, but the commentary was shit, wasn't it? And he went, what? I was like, the commentary must have been awful. And he went, no. What do you mean? And I was like, well, didn't you notice all the big pauses in it? And he went, no. No, didn't notice any pauses. And that actual moment was a massive turning point. Then I got back to my room and I listened to it. And the pauses that had been forced in that I couldn't do on my own, that literally they flew my commentary coach to France just to tell me when to start and stop talking. can you believe that, man? Like, can you believe that? That's how it went down. But that actually, that was the turning point. And after that, I kind of got it, you know? I did kind of get it a little bit more. And it's, but you know, it's a constant work to be a good commentator. Like, I just did a Fort William, 10 years of Fort William, this kind of like fantasy Fort William show. And, you know, when I watched it back, it was a different one because it was all World Cup, but all winning runs. But, you know, my energy was too much. It was wrong anyway, what I did. I wasn't very happy with what I did. You know, and it was probably because I haven't commentated since last September. You know, it's nearly a year now since I've commentated. So, you know, it's like riding a bike. You have to stay practicing. You need to keep doing these things to be good at them, but it'll come back. But that was an eye-opener the other day doing that, you know?
So it was a pretty big challenge for you to change your commentating, but can you imagine how it was for your coach that he got a phone call from Red Bull and they told him, dude, we need some help. Could you take him as a client? And he was watching your first video and maybe he was thinking, oh man, what should I do with him?
Maybe. Yeah, I would imagine, dude. Yeah, I'd imagine. He's also like a, this dude, right? He's ultra clever as well. He's like his house is full of books and shit, like where you sit in this sort of study thing. And like the couch was a bit like one of them ones you can lay on. And at one point he did tell me that he's also a psychologist. And I was like, what's a psychologist? And he was like, I was like, is that a shrink? And he was like, yeah. So I was like, oh my God, this is getting worse. Am I here for commentary coaching or for like, because, you know, I need real help in life. We never ventured into that, luckily, but I'm sure it was on his mind, like, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do with this fella? Do you know what I mean? But yeah, it was funny. It was funny. And, you know, joking aside, like, honestly, without his help, I wouldn't have a job now. And without Red Bull's help, I wouldn't have a job now. So all joking aside, I have no regrets about any of that. And I'm incredibly thankful to everyone who got me to where I am. You know what I mean? Because you won't do it on your own, really. I don't think you can. I think you probably, you know, you do need help. You do need to know how to do it. The commentary is, there's a lot goes on in commentary. It's probably my favourite aspect of the job, really, the commentary, more than the presenting. I love the commentary, you know. It's so hard to get it right. It's so hard to get it right. But you can be so, you know, it's just words, man. But it's amazing what you can do with words, isn't it? You know what I mean? So I love it. Yeah, I do love it.
The sport has become more and more professional in the last years. And you have helped to make the sport more professional. By the way, you're commentating.
Wow, that's a statement. I have made mountain biking more professional. I never thought I'd hear that, bro.
Did you ever dream that you would be responsible for professionalizing the sport?
that's one hell of a statement that is. I don't know. I think it's a natural progression of the sport, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it's... I don't know. I don't think it's anything to do with me. I would feel that I haven't led it. I've kept up with the professional. I don't know. It's a good question, actually. The whole thing with proper TV coverage, I think, has made the sport more professional. Of course it has. It's brought more money in. I mean, so, you know, all these things, yeah, add up to what the sport is now. And, you know, I think we might not have all the lunatics we had in the mid-90s and some of those big characters, but we've got the best racing we've ever had, and that's miles more important than anything else, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like, it's never been better to watch than it is now. It's insane to watch now. It's incredible.
Definitely. So the sport is super professional and the athletes training like hell. But yeah. For me, it's, you know, if this rider is not the fastest, there will be another one. But I think the sport has more to do with how you can present it. Because you have a couple of examples. If you see the MotoGP on television, or you see the Supercross in the US, there is a completely different style of commentating, and I really enjoy more the US style, the Supercross style. And it's the same with Darwin.
Just quickly, I would give my left ball. I shouldn't have said, you know what I mean? I'd love to be Ralph Shaheen, man. Now that dude's got the voice, isn't he?
Yeah.
Huh? Let's light the candles in Minnesota. It's like, yeah, I love it, dude.
It's so much more.
The American Supercross commentary is great. Well, you know, I would love to be. Yeah, I try and live up to the Supercross a little bit. Like, I definitely watch the Supercross with an eye on the commentary, because I love Ralph and his big voice. Man, he can bring so much energy and just a sentence. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's good. Yeah.
And then you're watching the MotoGP or the MXGP, and he say, "Oh, this guy had a moment," and that's it. I mean, there is so much going on, and he just, "This guy had a moment." So
yeah, like it's a bit flatter. Yeah.
And it's
no, that's right. You need it, mate. We're in, you know, downhill is like, it's mental. It's hot. It's massively spectacular and wild. You can't. As professional as it is, you've got to, and same with the Supercross. You know, you've got to acknowledge what they're doing. You've got to realise that what they're doing is so real, man. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, and you've got to react in commentary to bring that across, without a doubt. For me, and I guess, you know, it depends on your personality, but I am genuinely excited when I watch it. So it's easy for me. You know what I mean? I stand up and scream at the Supercross regular.
Yeah.
So even though I'm not actually commentating on it, but I mean,
it gets me all the time. And when now you have the chance to watch the Darwin World Cups in English with you, and then the German one.
Oh yeah.
And you're watching
and
the
Portuguese
same.
Portuguese and everything.
You're watching the same race, and it's completely different.
Yeah, well, I've never obviously watched one in another language, because I can't speak any other languages for a start. But yeah, I'd be interested to be able to watch one. But
I really think that commentating is one really big piece to the puzzle to make the sport, successful.
Oh yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, like, I think a good commentary, it can make or. The commentary can make or break a sport, and that's across the board. That's any sport. I feel like, really, that I don't know, but I feel sometimes like you shouldn't notice the commentary. The commentary should just be there and be good. If it's annoying, it's crap. You know, when you watch commentary and like you notice the commentary and you're like, oh shit, I don't know, in a bad way anyway, and you're like, oh shit, what are you on about, mate? That's rubbish. I mean, I'm sure I say things that people say like that all the time, but you know, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. If commentary's bad, it can destroy an event. Yeah. That's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah.
Definitely.
Definitely. Definitely.
So not only the athlete has changed a lot, also the technique on the bikes. What is the biggest development of the last year? What makes the bike so much better than before?
In the last year or in the last years?
I mean, the last years.
Well, I think it's everything. I really do. You know, it is like the bike's got bigger, the wheels got bigger, the suspension got better, more travel. The tyre technology is incredible now. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I couldn't get to the bottom back in the day without getting a flat tyre. Now, rarely see punctures. You know, just everything has come together to make this sport what it is now, which is incredible to watch, isn't it? It's mental, isn't it, when you watch it, how fast they go.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, the riders themselves, of course, like you said, you know, they've become athletes, real athletes now. So, yeah, you know, that also, yeah, that's right. They're built for the job in hand. And, you know, if it's, they're built for 3 minutes, man, and that's what they do at extremely high, extremely high speed. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's phenomenal, isn't it, to watch.
So you're also presenting several video formats like Rob Meets, where you spend time with different athletes and get to train with them.
And
And you, you're also presenting Rob Waters Wild Rides. So where you fly remote regions and search for the most exotic trails.
Is it,
Isn't it the biking what excites you the most on these kind of stuff? Or is it the different landscapes and cultures and all this side?
Well, they're two very different shows, really. Like, so like you say, meets, I go and meet athletes. The best, very nearly always the, you know, the best at what they do or very close to it, you know, that they, so I get to meet some incredible people, you know what I mean? Like, I was in New Zealand with Mad Mike Wadette, you know what I mean? Or I was in Sheffield this a few months ago with Sean Acoxy, you know, learning how to climb, one of the world's best, you know, climbers. I mean, to see her in action was just incredible. And so that, that series is, I love it, man. I do. I get to do a bit of. I quite enjoy research. I don't mind admitting that. So I get to research the athlete. I get to find out about a new sport, and then I get to go and meet them and live it with them. So that, you know, the people I've met and where I've been with that meet series is just unbelievable. And it, you know, it, that that's been, you know, that's one of the best things I've ever done. That is, and Wild Rides was kind of a, for me, it was a different series because on meets I'm the presenter.
Yeah.
Whereas in Wild Rides, I can kind of be more me. Not that they can use most of me being me. But, you know, that, so Wild Rides, yeah, Wild Rides was very, very exciting as well. And I can't explain quite how much I love doing it. I went away on a trip for 4 months. That whole series was, well, actually, meets came in as well. And I just, I left. I think I left in January and I came home a week before the first race, 3 days actually before the first race in Maribor last year. So, but yeah, it was an insane, an insane undertaking to go and travel. And, you know, but I loved, well, it's too much to even talk about. I was riding volcanoes in Ecuador. I was in Colombia, like, I don't just, you know, one day. The next day I was in Nepal. Then I was flying in a plane up to Jomsen and in the biggest mountains in the world, riding up there. It didn't get above freezing for a week, you know. And then I was in Africa, like, next couple of days later, I was in Africa hanging out with a tribe who were eating goat. You know what I mean? It was just, yeah, it was bonkers. But what a trip of a lifetime that was. You know, I'll never forget that, and I'll never forget the people I met on that Wild Rides trip. Yeah, it was incredible. And you know, on top of that, like you said, I got to ride my mountain bike a lot, which was bloody brilliant. And I got to really go mountain biking. Like, it wasn't bike park. It was real mountain biking, you know, the wilderness, like dropped off by helicopter on the top of a peak and see you in 6 hours. It was all like that. So, yeah, it was absolutely phenomenal, mate. Yeah. And I loved it. And I'm proud of that series. And I like both those series, actually. But I'm almost really proud that I got through all of Wild Rides because it was like, it was, you know, I was riding a lot. And on blind trails and stuff. And I was sort of waiting to have a big accident, but it didn't come, luckily. So.
And not to get eaten by a lion or like the...
Yeah, we saw some lions, mate. We see a rhino squared up with us. Yeah. That was genuinely arse-twitching, that was. I was like, whoa. Mate, he was like, if that fucking thing charges, we're in trouble, you know. And it was square on. So, yeah, it was great. And I met these African tribes, mate, these tribes I hung out with. I slept in mud huts a lot. On the African leg, and fucking hell, man, it was the most eye-opening thing I've ever experienced, actually, to see how these people live and how happy they are living like that. You know what I mean? They got nothing, but it was, but they'll give you everything. Yeah, it was absolutely insane. I mean, you imagine like rocking up to an African tribe, and you know they had bushes all around that they pulled up, like big spiky bushes, like it was the boundary of the village. And I was like, what's that? And they were like, oh yeah, it's to stop the elephants trampling you in the night. I mean, it's just shit, like, and all the light and tigers coming and eating everyone. Like, yeah, great. It was like, it was just mental. Yeah, it was wild. Really good fun, mate. Yeah, they knew how to party. They liked to drink, those lot. They were cool.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, they brewed their own stuff. Yeah, it was wild.
So if you had to pick one trip out of these wild rides, which country would it be?
Oh, mate.
Oh, I think this God. Is probably the hardest question.
It's virtually an impossible question to answer, that is. Good God. So I can't answer that, really. Probably Africa stands out. As you know, I went to Kenya and Lesotho, and just because they're culturally so different to anything I've ever experienced, those probably stand out, you know what I mean? Like, they were probably the wildest of the trip. But you know, Ecuador, I was riding down Cotopaxi volcano. That's something I'll never forget, ever. I'll never ever forget riding a mountain bike down a fucking volcano, man. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it was absolutely mental. So there was New Zealand, of course. I'd never been to New Zealand before, and it surpassed all my expectations, which were, you know, incredibly high. So yeah, the world's a beautiful place, man. You've got to get out there and see it, haven't you? And I've been lucky enough to do that with that series, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, let's hope for some more of that.
And which country is still on top of your bucket list?
I don't know. For some reason, I really want to go to Iceland.
Yeah.
I'm desperate to go to Iceland, see all that. They got I've got a thing for volcanoes that developed in Ecuador, really. when I first set eyes on Cotopaxi, it was love at first sight. So yeah, I do like a volcano, mate. They blow my mind, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, more of that, really. Yeah, more of that. Yeah, Iceland would be amazing to go to. Yeah, and do some riding, definitely.
That sounds really good. Then you have to, you should go to Russia, to Kamchatka. There are a lot of big volcanoes.
Is there really?
Yeah, it is.
Well, if there's a Wild Rise Series 2, I shall put that forwards.
Definitely.
I'll put that forwards. Yeah, I'd love to see that. Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Rob, thank you very much for your time. It was
pleasure, my man. And oh, it's been great fun. Thank you.
Hopefully, we will see us soon, and hopefully the World Cup racing starts pretty soon. So thanks a lot, and well,
fingers crossed, man. We're all praying very much for the races kicking off in September, aren't we? So yeah, fingers crossed. I hope so.
Definitely. Thanks a lot.
All right, mate. Yeah, thanks, bro. See you in a bit. Ta-da. Bye-bye. Auf Wiedersehen.